if you do want to be first, and of course that's what they were arguing about, who is the most important? Who's the most significant? And Peter, James, and John are thinking, well, it's got to be one of us. I mean, we went up on the mountain. He said, okay, you got it wrong. If you truly do want to be the most important, then you have to take the posture of being the least. That's the way it operates in God's kingdom. Do you see that in the church world? Hardly ever. Like I said, I think it's the most disobeyed of all the things that Jesus said. Historically, the church is pretty much exactly the opposite. Before I came to Calvary Chapel, I grew up in a denomination filled with celebrities and demigods and, you know, people posturing for positions of power and power struggles in churches, and that was all I knew. And of course, when we didn't really study the Bible, pastors just preached or yelled at us or talked about how to get God to give us what we wanted, you know, how to have the right kind of leverage prayers to get God to be your servant, or other such power-oriented or success-oriented teaching. But I had been in that denomination for 20 years before I came to Calvary Chapel. I never heard one sermon ever on these very things that Jesus said. And he says, this is the way the kingdom runs. I never heard anybody either say it or teach it or live it out. And it was stunning to me when I saw how what he said, how clear it was, and when I saw how many times he said it, I thought, how could this be missed? How could it possibly be ignored? Well, the simplest answer to that is it's just not the way the world runs. If you follow these very things that we looked at in just these few verses and you live your life that way out in the world will treat you like a doormat, just like they did Jesus. People aren't going to think you're great, even in the church world. There are people that will treat you like a doormat. So the real deal is to look at what Jesus says, and then we all have a choice that we make, and that is whose approval are we going to live our lives for? That would have ended the argument about who was the greatest if they'd had just heeded this. It's interesting that he brings the child, and most of our time today we'll be talking about this whole phrase of what it means to be like a child, what that looks like and what it doesn't look like. And I noted as I was peeking ahead in chapter 10. Chapter 10 finds people, crowds of people, bringing their children to Jesus, and the disciples he said these very things to about welcoming a child in my name. It's what like welcoming me. These very disciples were trying to prevent people from bringing their children to Jesus. You're bothering him. So that's so sobering, because I don't know how it could be any more clear than it is. So let's look about it. He gives them opportunity to be honest, and they weren't. So he starts out and he says, you know, if you want to be great in God's kingdom, Matthew 23:11 is where that song came from that we sang this morning. He said, if you truly do want to be significant and important in God's kingdom, it's an upside down kingdom. It doesn't work the way the world's kingdom works. Learn to be the servant of everyone. Take that posture of the least. And then in God's eyes, in the king's eyes, in his kingdom, you will be great. Did anybody model that for us to see what it looks like? Well, the king himself modeled it, didn't he? I was at a pastor's conference once, a Calvary Chapel pastor's conference, where Gail Irwin was teaching on this, and I love Gail's books. The Jesus Style, I think, is one of those should be required reading for all people in ministry. Just an examination of the way Jesus ministered and how different that is from ministers who wear his name. And Gail said something I'll never forget. He said, you need to look at your life and look at all the stuff that's there and the way you live your life and say, if there's anything there that doesn't say I'm a servant, then dump it, get rid of it. Model yourself after Jesus, not after other leaders, which is how it can run amok so quickly. Historically, this has been so violated that it just it seems normal. I remember Sue was telling me, well, I mean, the last time that I taught this, that she actually attended a business seminar where somebody was talking about servant leadership. Be really curious to know how that went over, because for the most part in the business world, this will not work. It won't even work in God's kingdom when God's kingdom is being run like a business. You know what I mean? It doesn't work in the secularized part of the world, simply because that's just not the way humans are. But it was refreshing. It was encouraging to realize that there's somebody. I think, didn't you tell me that they turned out to be believers, those people that taught that? And I thought, well, yeah, that's the only people that would have ever come up with that. Our whole culture says exactly the opposite, doesn't it? Our whole culture says, believe in yourself, learn to get other people to help you fulfill your dreams and achieve your full potential. And of course, I've been part of the church for my whole life. And I've seen that so much in the church that when you say these words that our Lord Jesus says, you sound weird. It's like swimming against the current to decide to live your life this way. And once again, I'll say what I said earlier. It just brings you to that point of choice. Well, then who am I going to live my life for their approval? You know, the church or God's kingdom, the king himself, the world's approval. I have to make that choice. I don't think people even expect religious leaders to be this way. There are so few that are. John the Baptist had it totally wired. John the Baptist said to his disciples, when Jesus came along, John said to his disciples, he says, you need to stop following me. Now you need to follow that guy. And of course, they were following John the Baptist because they liked his style. They believed in his message. But he said that most important thing that you hardly ever hear preached in the 21st century American church. He said, he must increase, and so I must decrease. But that's just positively un-American, isn't it? I mean, the American view of it is, dear Jesus, please make me famous, and then I'll tell people what a nice guy you are. And our whole vision of God being glorified in our life is that we're rich and famous, and then we're able to tell people, well, I'm rich and famous because of Jesus. So let's all give Jesus a hand, and you know that I'm going to pass the glory off to him. And John the Baptist says, you know what? In order for Jesus to be increased, I need to decrease. Here's an interesting endorsement. Jesus himself said about John the Baptist, he said, there has never been born of any woman on this planet a greater man than John the Baptist. So apparently the increase and decrease thing, John understood it and Jesus understood it. The disciples eventually did, but they had no model. It wasn't the way the religious leaders of Israel were. It wasn't the way the worldly leaders were. They had no model except for Jesus. And it took them a while to even understand that. I think pretty much with the ordinary rank and file of the world system, you won't be appreciated if you live this way. you will be greatly appreciated by your Heavenly Father and those that know Him and value what He values. There are folks in our church that model this so beautifully. And you might know who they are and you might not know who they are. You probably don't know who cleans your toilets and who cleans up after the mess that we leave in this building. You probably don't even know. Because that's not why they're doing it, is so that you'll know. But Jesus knows. Every time I feel underappreciated, which is not that often, I am a whiner, so, you know, I can get up a good head of steam feeling underappreciated. He just reminds me that He notices and that He appreciates, and so what's the big deal? Why does anybody else have to notice, and why does anybody else have to appreciate it? And of course, that does calm me down, and He almost always will take me back to these passages. Let's look at the little child. He took a little child. I think the fact that that adjective little is used is important, because he's talking about a very young child before their parents or other adults have had a chance to ruin them. The very young child that's still in that state of purity, where there are things that they model that we need to copy. So that's important. Matthew says that he called the little child. Let's flip over to Matthew. We'll look at these few verses in Matthew 18. Matthew says that he called the child to him. And so here's a confined environment with a bunch of big, burly, hairy guys who were in a bad mood because they all just got busted for being jerks. And you know how people can kind of give off that sort of vibe? And Jesus calls this little child, and the child comes. Somebody pointed out that says a lot about Jesus, that a little child in that kind of an environment would have felt safe to come close to Him, to come up into His arms, to be on display. I think that's noteworthy. Have you noticed that most of the people that hung out with Jesus, who we wouldn't call them disciples in the formal way, but they hung out with Him constantly, that there were a lot of abused women in that group? There were people who were branded by their society as being failures. There were people that hung out with Jesus that none of the religious leaders in their own country would have invited to their home. And yet they felt safe with Jesus. And that is my heart's desire. I personally, from experience, do not believe that every church is a safe place. I think they're supposed to be. I sure want this one to be. I sure rejoice whenever I see any church that's a safe place. But we don't have that reputation in the world as a group. Church people. So Jesus calls the child comes, that's a big deal. Do you know the only autobiographical statement that Jesus ever made about His personality? The only one. The adjective that He used to describe Himself was gentle and humble in heart. Do you know any ungentle Christians? Do you know any ungentle leaders? I could give you a list of names of other ministers I'm afraid of. I fear them, which is exactly the opposite of feeling safe. It's significant that the child came to Him. And then He draws attention to the child in Matthew 18. And He said, verse 3, I'm telling you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Those are sobering words. Who's he talking to? When he says you, it's plural, by the way. Both of those yous are plural in the Greek text. Unless you change, you will never enter. Who's he talking to? Pagans? Satan worshipers? Liberal Democrats? I'm trying to think of some other group in disfavor. He's talking to his own followers. Those become sobering words, don't they? The word change is an interesting word. We looked at it the last Wednesday study that we did. We looked at a form of this Greek word. The Greek word for change here is the word strepho, S-T-R-E-P-H-O, strepho. It literally means to alter one's course. We looked at in the very last two verses in James, it was, I think, a really important study about confronting people that are wandering off course and how you could be rescuing them from disaster. The word that James uses for altering someone's course is the word epistrepho, which is not just to alter your course, but it means to alter your course and go all the way back to the course that you were originally on that's the correct one. So it's an even stronger word. Interesting that in a couple of weeks we've looked at this very same word. So he looks at these disciples and he said, you guys, unless you alter the course that you are on right now, you, my disciples, my followers, you won't even enter the kingdom of God, much less be the greatest. I mean, you're arm wrestling over which one of you is the most important, and guys, you're in a little bit danger of whether you're even going to get in unless you alter your course. I do find that those words really sobering. And then he takes the opportunity to talk about becoming like a child, unless you alter your course and become like little children. So I have a fairly substantial rabbit trail. If you take notes, you might want to write some of these things down. I wrote down five things that could characterize being childlike. By the way, there's a difference between childlikeness and childishness. One is good, one is not good. Five things I wrote down that are childlike. And of course, then I wrote five things down that are exactly the opposite of that. See which applies to this group. See which applies to ourselves, which apply to the perception that we have of religious people in general. Five things I wrote down that are characteristics of childlikeness. Five. Sincerity. Sensitivity. The word sincerity simply has to do with being real, being transparent, no pretense. Sincerity, sensitivity, humility, trusting, and dependence. Let's talk about those. Nobody does transparency better than little children. I mean, it doesn't take long for children to learn to posture and manipulate and do all of that. In fact, it's frightening how quickly they can learn that. But if you take, you know, the child that Jesus is talking about, the very young child that's just sort of popped into the world, they're not polluted yet by the models that they're following. One of the first things you can say about them is that they're real. My observation is that a lot of church people find people who are real to be threatening. But Jesus said, this ought to be characteristic of what my followers think, especially you guys, my disciples. This is what you need to be like. You need to be real. One of my very favorite old English words is the word guileless. It simply means without pretense. No hidden agenda. What you see is what you get. I tend to be drawn to people like that. The thing that I've noticed about children is that until they learn how to be phony, they're the most real people there are. It's like the wedding that I told you about, that little, oh, isn't that romantic? And I forget which girl it was, Ashley or one of the little girls said, oh, yeah. She's standing in a room filled with adults at a serious ceremony. And of course, she won't even think about that until she's 13, and then she'll be mortified and be afraid to show herself in public. But when they're in that transparent, absolutely real way, let me ask you, do church people in general have a reputation for being real? Pretty much they don't. In fact, in a lot of places, if you walk in and you're trying to be real, they won't like you. They will want you to leave. So I do find it significant that when Jesus said to his disciples, you guys need to alter course, you're not going to get into the kingdom unless you have qualities that this very small child has, one of them would have to be sincerity, realness, transparency. Sensitivity is another one. All of their receptors are just turned on full blast. That's why they can be hurt so easily. Think about this. I pondered this, and I thought, why do people, as they grow older, stop being that way? The answer is really simple. It's because you can get hurt. So we figure, you know, if I just stop being open to and have my feelings all out there, then I won't ever get hurt. I didn't want to be a pastor again because I'd been one before and I had sheep bites all over my body, so I was a little nervous hanging around sheep, you know. And I remember when we started this fellowship, of course, hardly any of those people are still here. But when we first started, the Lord spoke to me and he said, look, if you're going to do this right, you are going to have to be willing to let these people hurt you. There isn't a way that you can do this and protect yourself any more than Jesus could do what he did and protect himself. And that's one of the ways that children are characterized, is by that kind of sensitivity. No self-protection. Third thing is humility. Willing to learn. Because for a child, their whole life is learning. They don't know anything. So pretty much, they're not intimidated by having to learn new stuff. It's all new stuff. When I used to teach piano lessons many years ago, I loved teaching children, but I hated teaching adults. Because adults are not used to being bad at something. And if they find out they can't do something, they get angry or they sulk. And little kids, pretty much, unless they have another kind of a model that's teaching them otherwise, a little kid pretty much approaches everything as a learning experience. And I found them to be great students. They were not as intimidated as adults. It's my personal theory, and you don't have to believe anything I say about children, because I don't have any. I just have 19 nieces and nephews and many grandnieces and nephews. And I've been a pastor for a long time. But I personally think that when children are intimidated by learning, they learn that from adults. They don't know something's hard until an adult tells them it's hard. Because I have noticed that when children are affirmed in things that they feel not good at, they can sometimes get over that hump really fast. Oh, this isn't hard. I can do this. Oh, okay. And the next thing you know, they thought they'd never learn how to read. And the next thing you know, they're voracious readers. That's just my little input there. Humility. Simple, willing to learn. Once again, that's not a characteristic that church people, especially leaders, are known for, is it? Trusting. We sang some songs about that today, too. it's another reason why children get hurt, is because they are trusting. They trust people they shouldn't trust.